first world championship in the history of the Minnesota Twins would not have been possible without their well-tuned left-hander winning three postseason games, including Game 7 of the World Series against the St. Louis Cardinals. That October performance took place in 1987. But 6 years prior in the NCAA regionals, Frank Viola was in the spotlight again during his standout college days at St. John's University, as he was the winning pitcher in an incredible mound duel against another eventual big leaguer. Ron Darling of Yale tossed 11 no-hit innings with 16 strikeouts. Viola matched him with 11 shutout frames and 8 Ks. In the top of the 12th, Darling allowed his first hit, which led to the only run in a St. John's victory. I began by asking Frank what he recalls most from that game, one that is still considered by many to be the greatest pitched in college baseball history.
Pretty much that, which you said at the very end. I've been involved in baseball from Little League on up for 47 years now, and to be perfectly honest, to this day, it is still the best pitch game I have ever witnessed in person. That's how dominating Ron Darling was that day, and it's funny because at St. John's we had a very cocky team to start with. We didn't think anybody could beat us. And after the first inning, our number three hitter came in at the end of the inning after Ron got him out. And he looked at the dugout and said, "Oh my God, this is the toughest pitcher I've ever seen." And that was the first inning. So you knew how intimidating, you know, Ron's presence was at that point, especially for an Ivy League like a Yale University guy. So it was a great thing. And the best part about the whole thing is after we won it, years later, Ron and I have something, every time we run into each other, we have something very special in common that we shared, and that probably could be the best college baseball game ever, so it's pretty cool.
I take it you weren't on a pitch count limit then.
What's a pitch count?
I don't know. Do you know how many you threw?
I threw in the vicinity of around 150-ish. And I know Ron threw somewhere in the 190 vicinity. But the best part about that story was after you lost, you had to come back the next day and play the loser's bracket game late morning before the winners played in the afternoon. So we get there around the fifth inning, and we look out in the field, and Ron's not only playing, but he's playing in right field. And this is after throwing 190-plus pitches the night before, what have you. And we're sitting there in the stands waiting for the game to end, and there was a fly ball hit to right field with the man on third base in around the seventh inning. And Ron caught the ball and threw a one-hop strike to the catcher from 300 feet out. And I looked at my teammates and says, "I can't even move my arm right now." And he's making a throw like that after what he did the day before. You know, he was an incredible athlete, and it was so funny that we were able to witness that the next day.
Yeah, his arm was still fresh. That's pretty amazing. Now, you were drafted in 1981 by the Twins, debuted in June of 82, and it was 1984 when you began to hit your stride with 18 victories, and you remained a consistent starter through 1987, a year in which the Twins won the American League West, but were facing the Detroit Tigers, who had the best record in baseball and the American League Championship Series. Did a scenario like that, I think your team was outscored as well throughout the entire season, did a scenario like that give the team a nothing-to-lose attitude going into the series?
Well, we felt like we were the underdogs, but after we looked back, we realized, you know, we had as much talent as anybody else out there. The thing was that we were a terrible road team that year. We were very, very strong at the Metrodome, which, as everybody knows, was a major home field advantage. And we also played the American League West at that time. It was just American League West, the American League East, and it wasn't the strongest of divisions, so we ended up winning and clinching with a couple of weeks to go in the season. The thing people don't realize is that Detroit and Toronto ended up going down to like the last or the second to last game of the regular season trying to fight for that playoff spot. So Detroit coming into the American League Championship Series probably had a little downside, you know, that came down a little bit because it took so much to get into the playoffs. And so long story short, you know, we had an advantage, we had some rest, we were ready to go, and Detroit had just come off, a very tough series against whoever to try making the playoffs. So, you know, it just seemed like all the stars were aligned right for us, and I don't think we gave ourselves enough credit, as I mentioned earlier, about our talent, but when you look at the players that played on that team in 87, you know, we can go up against pretty much anybody when you watch it.
And it was about that time, as you said, that the Metrodome crowd became nationally known for its decibel levels and obviously the opponents, especially a National League opponent, as we face in the World Series, had to get used to that dome, not only the roof with the fly balls, but also the noise. But as a pitcher, even though they're all on your side, is there any bit of distraction? And the comparison I think of is like a quarterback at home trying to tell the crowd to lessen the noise. Is there any bit of distraction from a pitcher's point of view?
For me, no. Yeah, you know, it's, you know, when you're pitching well and things are going well, you have tunnel vision. You know, it's just you and the catcher, and that's all it is. After the fact, absolutely. I mean, my ears were ringing for like 3 or 4 days after the playoffs and the World Series and so on. But at the time, you know, I think, as you mentioned, we had such a major advantage playing 81 home games there and getting acclimated to it and watching as we got closer and closer to clinching the title. We had more and more fans coming, so we got used to the 40,000 to 50,000 to 55,000 fans with a couple of weeks left of the season. So we became acclimated to the noise, the sounds. You know, and they say it was as loud as a plane taking off when it's at its highest decibel, which is very cool. But as an athlete, I think St. Louis went overboard in the World Series, you know, using cotton balls in their ears and this, that, the other. You know, you just got to do what you got to do. And fortunately for us, just being acclimated and or not caring made a big difference to our ball club.
So after beating Detroit in 5 games, winning both games at home, you had a no decision in game one, but won the 4th game. But the LCS win put you in the World Series against the Cardinals, a team that was known for its small ball, its speed, and that would be even more emphasized because they had injuries to their 2 power hitters, Jack Clark and Terry Pendleton. You had the starting assignment for game one in Minnesota. How much of a concern personally was it facing and getting acclimated maybe to a team of that style of play, a style of play that's more identified with the National League?
It wasn't that big of a deal just for the fact that I had learned how to go to instruction league after my first half a year in the big leagues to learn to slide step to keep runners close. In 2/3 of a year, my first year in 82, I believe I was one of the top 5 easiest pitchers to run on because I had a high leg kick and a lousy move to first base. So the Twins sent me to instruction league to work on a slide step, which is basically just getting the ball to play quicker to give your catcher a chance to throw people out. And, you know, be it St. Louis or anybody, once I got the feel for that slide step, I didn't even worry about the running game because I knew that the catcher had plenty of time to get the guys out. So, you know, a speed team like St. Louis was not a big deal to me. It also helped that I was left-handed because I was looking at the base runner. So, you know, from that standpoint, it wasn't any different from facing any other team.
One out, base is empty. Ozzie gone. Quickly, 2 down. The crowd is already frenzied.
Another look at the changeup, which makes him such an effective pitcher. Out on his front foot, his left shoulder is already open. Again, he has to respect the 90-mile-per-hour fastball. Doesn't have a chance.
It didn't take long for you to figure out the Cardinals. In game one, with plenty of offensive support, allowed just 1 run, a 10-1 victory. And that came, I recall, on a day in which you had another special obligation, right?
Yeah, my brother got married that day, and it's so funny because the year before we came in last place, and my brother called and says, "You think we're safe in October of next year?" And I said, you know, tongue in cheek, I said, you know, I don't see how we're going to improve that much to get to the point where anything is going to deter from me getting to the wedding. And sure enough, a year later, yeah, I am playing in the World Series. So I was the best man, so I had to send a tape. Take a VHS tape and tape a best man speech and have it sent out to New York, and they had to set everything up there. But it worked out well. And the best part about the whole thing was my brother and his wife, my sister-in-law, ended up coming back from their honeymoon, and they detoured to Minnesota for Game 7. So they were part of the celebration when we did win after Game 7.
Yeah, in between, unfortunately, it didn't go as well. Game 4 in St. Louis, home run by Tom Lawless, 4 other earned runs, led to the Cards evening the series at 2. How badly did you want to get back out there, especially when they went up 3-2 after Game 5? How badly did you want to go out there and have that chance to start Game 7, that opportunity to finish the season in a different fashion?
Well, first of all, you know, just to be able to say you pitch at Game 7 is every boy's dream when they're growing up. So from that standpoint, that was the first thing that I really would, you know, that was on my mind. But as you said, you know, I wanted to redeem myself after Game 4 because I made a pitch to a guy that was just a, you know, a really bad hitter. I mean, back be told, the guy only hit two career home runs and one of them the grand slam in the World Series against me. So, you know, it wasn't the greatest pitches. It wasn't the greatest of days for me, Game 4. But it happens. That's part of the game. And I was just, you know, being able to get that opportunity in Game 7 to redeem myself and help my team. And the best part was in Game 6, Ken Herbert hit that grand slam around the 6th, 7th inning off of Ken Daly. And I looked at my teammates. I said, that's it. I'm getting my chance, and we're going to make something of it. And fortunately, it all worked out.
The 1987 baseball season concludes tonight. The 7th game of the World Series under the dome in Minneapolis. The St. Louis Cardinals against the Minnesota Twins. It's McGrane against Viola. I'm Al Michaels, and isn't this the way it should be? You start at the end of February, and you finish it on the 25th of October, one game for the championship.
Yeah, the Game 6 victory led to Game 7 in the Metrodome, and at that point, the home team won all 6 games and, of course, win all 7. In that Game 7, you allowed a pair of early runs, but gathered yourself after the second inning as the offense would eventually put up 4 runs. What adjustment did you make that helped you shut down St. Louis through the 8th inning?
Well, first of all, it was the third time you faced the same team, so they got a pretty good book on you like you have on them. And what happened was, you know, I have Roy Smalley to thank more than anybody, because after the second inning, I'd given up 2 runs, like you mentioned, and of those 2 runs, I gave up 2 runs points in the second inning. And Roy looked at me at the end of the inning and said, "Do you realize what pitch you gave up all 4 hits on?" And I was thinking about it, and I said, "Oh my God, I gave up all four hits on my changeup." So he said, "Yeah, they're probably sitting back and waiting for it." So over the next 6 innings, as you mentioned, I was able to go 8-4. And over the next 6 innings, I think I threw 70 or thereabouts pitches, and 68 of them were fastballs. And I think I only gave up 1 hit. And it was, you know, I have Roy to be thankful for, because if he didn't point that out to me, I don't even know if I'd have been out there that long. So it made a big difference in my Game 7, and, you know, on top of that, to be named the, you know, World Series MVP after that, Roy had a lot to do with that.
Was that something, the MVP, was that something you would even consider? I doubt you even, like, think about it when you're focusing so much, but that had to be...
I'll tell you a secret. After the 8th inning, when Tom Kelly took me out of the game for Jeff Ridden, which I didn't like in the first place because I really wanted to finish when I started, but, you know, Jeff was such a quality reliever, all I was thinking about was, once Jeff got that last out, not to have my legs collapse before I run into the pile of celebration. You know, the last thing on my mind was somebody coming up to me and saying, "You know what, if you win, you're going to be the World Series MVP." As I said, it's a special honor, so on and so forth. There's so many people who could have had that. You know, we did the team. It was a team thing from day one that year in 87. And, you know, I just happened to be named, but it was just a great honor, regardless one way or the other.
To Gaetti, for the first time ever, the Minnesota Twins are the world champions.
Oh, it's a tremendous feeling. You know, MVP is a great, great honor, but I couldn't do it without the other 23 guys, and they all should share in this. I was able to forget about Game 4 now. I have a nice winter ahead with Game 7, and all the guys made it possible, and that's the way we played all year. It's just an incredible, incredible feeling.
How was it playing for Tom Kelly, who would actually win another championship in 91, but how was it playing for him? Just from me looking from afar, he seemed to be a guy that really got along with his players, even though he never played a major league game.
He's the best. You know, to this day, he's still my favorite. Just for the fact that, yeah, you're right. He didn't have any major league experience, but he knew how to talk to players, knew how to handle players. And once he started preaching something, we bought in. You know, if you have a game plan, you stick to that game plan, be it a coach, a player, whatever. If you have a game plan, people will, and you see the results of the game plan, people will start believing in. And the thing you mentioned, TK could be firm, he could yell at you, scream at you, but you respected him because once he got it out of his system, he didn't hold any grudges against you, he kept on going. And the most important thing that he was able to do was he also formed a friendship with the players, which a lot of managers don't do, especially today. Managers, they don't give a crap about their players, and I think that's where the game's gone to hell a little bit.
And momentum you generated from the 87 postseason had a carryover effect into 88 with a career-high 24 victories at the AL Cy Young. How much do you attribute what happened in October of 87 to what took place the following year with those 24 wins?
I mean, it helped because it built up so much confidence in yourself. But, you know, 88, it was just everything. You know, you couldn't have asked for a more magical individual season. I mean, I think the guys averaged 6.5 runs for me, and anybody can survive and prosper with 6.5 runs scored for you. And then on top of that, they played great defense behind me. It just seemed like everything just fell in place that year. You know, so as I said, you know, in the way your career goes, for me, it was winning the World Series. That's my number one. You know, that's number one on the top of the list, just for the fact that you did that as a team. But I guess the single individual accomplishment would have been the Cy Young year, just for the fact that, you know, just to be able to tell your kids that you won 24 games, your grandkids and stuff, that's pretty cool too.
Now, around the trade deadline of 1989, the Twins dealt you to the Mets and thus had the opportunity to play near home. Was going to New York and joining the Mets just plain coincidental? Like, was it a deal that benefited just a deal that benefited both sides, or was it a situation where management allowed you the opportunity to request a deal to the Mets?
No. Back then, I found all this out after the fact. I did a year of ESPN in 2004, and I finally got a chance to sit down with Andy McPhail, who was GM of the Cubs that time, and sit down and go over the whole scenario of what happened in that 1989 season. And he told me that from spring training on, I was traded. It didn't matter how good a year I had. I was traded just for the fact that I was the one trade that they had that they could build the team around by getting new personnel. But the problem was, in Andy's mind, or what happened was, I was supposed to be traded to the Yankees. But with a week left before the trade deadline, the Mets came into play because Doc Gooden had gotten hurt. And it was still in the pennant race. And the Mets, at the last second, put together an offer where the Twins couldn't, you know, they couldn't turn it down. It 5-for-1 trades, not bad for a team. You know, and in that trade, they got Rick Aguilera, who became one of the best closers in the game for a period of time. They got Kevin Tappany, who had a very nice career with the Twins and the Cubs and other teams. And the key to the trade was this left-hander by the name of David West, who basically ate himself out of the game. But at that time, he was the guy who was the key to the whole trade. So long story short, those three guys helped the Twins win the World Series in 91. So it was a trade that worked out fantastic for the Twins and for the Mets. It was great for me just for the fact that I got to go home and play for the team I rooted for when I was growing up.
After an off year in 89, you rebounded nicely with 20 wins for the second place Mets in 1990. And that last victory came on the final day of the season in Pittsburgh. In a situation like that, a milestone, going for a milestone win total, teammates sometimes keep you loose beforehand. In this game, you were the victim of a prank that carried over to when you took the mound, correct?
Yeah. First of all, you know, we had just gotten eliminated by Pittsburgh with a couple of days earlier. So I wasn't even sure I wanted to go out there and try winning the 20th because it was, as I said, you know, it's an individual accomplishment. The team thing, it didn't mean anything as far as the team was concerned. But my teammates said to me, hey, not too many people have an opportunity to win 20 games, you know, 20 games in both leagues. And so they talked me into going out there. And before warming up in the first inning, I started my warm-up pitches, and the umpires laughing at me. And, I mean, the umpires never really got along great to begin with, but he kept on laughing. So I finally stopped. I said, what the hell are you laughing at? And he points at my head. And I didn't know what he was talking about. And anyway, he just, then once again, he said, like, lift your hat up. So I lifted my hat up, and I had a whole bunch of shaving cream on top of my hat. I look into the dugout, and Ron Darling and John Franco were laughing their tails off because they had pranked me. And the good part was it loosened me up. I went out there and ended up pitching 7 innings and get the opportunity to win 20 games. So it all worked out for the best. But at the time, I was like, what is going on?
How did they get the shaving cream on your hat without you knowing?
I have no. I'm stupid as stuff. I just don't pay attention. I get shaving cream when it gets on top. You put it on quiet. I don't know. I guess it goes on quietly, and I wasn't paying attention, which is norm for me. I mean, even when I coach today, I don't even know. I get pranked even now, so I'm not the smartest tool in the shed. You know, one of those type of things.
Well, pretty good pitching coach, I might add. And you spent the last 5 years with the Mets organization.
So if that's your biggest headache, you got 2 or 3 years with. We didn't even mention Zach Wheeler in that. You know, when Zach comes back from his Tommy John surgery, you're talking about five absolute dominating pitchers on any given night. So, so New York Mets fan, you got a lot to look forward to.
2-2 to Puig. Got him. Slider from DeGrom strikes out Puig for the second time. Seven strikeouts through seven innings for Jacob DeGrom. Struck him out with a changeup. Number 12 for Syndergaard. A new career high and a Mets season high. Absolute dominance. 2-2 coming. Half swing, did he go? He went around strike three. Number 13 for Noah Syndergaard.
And I've heard you say in other interviews humbly how you deflect the credit for their success to the pitchers themselves. But there must be a small measure of pride that you take in seeing their development, seeing them do some of the things that you taught them now at the big league level.
Oh, it is. But you know what? It's the best way to explain what a coach does on the professional level is we're here for the kids. It has nothing to do with us. Our careers are over. We've accomplished everything we want to do in our playing days. It shouldn't be about us anymore. It should be about what can we do to make each individual kid the best they could be, so they have a chance to be big league pitchers. So if I've made a difference in these kids, it's fantastic. But as I said, it's just rewarding to see these kids successful, enjoying themselves, and going out there and competing. That's what it's all about.
Excellent, Frank. Well, best of luck the rest of the season with Las Vegas, and thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
All right. Good talking to you.
The early returns on the already formidable staff developing in New York indicate that all have the potential to join Viola in the ranks of Cy Young Award recipients, and there might even be a 20-game winner or two. But Frank has an even more distinct honor when it comes to pitchers who have notched at least 20 victories in a season. By recording the big 2-0 on the final day of the 1990 season, he is one of just 23 pitchers in history to reach that rare mark in both the American and National Leagues. That's all for this edition of Baseball as It Was. Brian Wright here, thanking you so much for listening and hoping you tune in next time.